Amory and 107.5 FM W298DK Amory, and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
ABC News, I'm Brian Clark. Severe weather overnight's been blamed for 3 deaths in North Dakota, but tens of millions of people will be dealing with dangerous heat over the next several days. Meteorologist Greg Dutcher from WLS in Chicago says,
where does the heat spread for today? It's across the entire Midwest. It's out to the eastern fringe of the Rocky Mountains and then all the way out to the eastern U.S. too, with Chicago hitting possibly 105 degrees when you factor in the heat index today.
President Trump plans to meet with his National Security Council as he weighs U.S. involvement in the Iran-Israel war. Israel overnight said it intercepted 40 Iranian drones. Iran says more than 400 people have been killed since the fighting began. Vice President J.D. Vance thanked Marines and military personnel working on immigration raids in Southern California. Los Angeles Mayor Karen Bass said he was justifying a stunt. And 8 people were killed in a ballooning accident in southern Brazil. This is ABC News. One group of cyber experts say billions of passwords have been compromised. ABC's Phil Lipoff has details.
Cybersecurity experts claim that as many as 16 billion with a B login credentials have possibly been leaked, giving criminals unprecedented access to accounts consumers use each and every day. Cyber News is this company, publishing a report this week saying it recently discovered 30 exposed data sets.
Meanwhile, law enforcement around the country is warning people to be alert for phone scams. Police in Oakland County, Michigan, say they're seeing a rise in phone scammers telling people they did not appear for jury duty and must pay a penalty. Sheriff Michael Bouchard says not only is one giveaway the urgency, scammers demanding money immediately, but also,
don't fall for it. We're not asking for money over the phone. Never will.
Graduation season coming to an end. One New York high school doubling down as graduation at Long Island's Plainview Old Bethpage boasts 15 sets of twins. I'm Brian Clark, ABC News.
The possibility of lung cancer can be pretty scary, especially if you're one of approximately 8 million current or former smokers at high risk. That's why SaveByTheScan.org wants you to know that now there's a breakthrough low-dose CT scan that can detect lung cancer early, and it only takes 60 seconds. You stop smoking, now start screening. For an easy quiz to see if you're eligible, visit SaveByTheScan.org. It could save your life. SaveByTheScan.org is brought to you by the American Lung Association's Lung Force Initiative and the Ad Council.
Mornings with Pat Kreitlow.
When Republicans try to be cute, they always end up looking like Wile E. Coyote in the old cartoons. Governor Evers is the Roadrunner, and his veto pen is the Acme anvil that keeps getting dropped on their heads. If what they want to do over the next few weeks is not pass a state budget, it would be best for them to get one of those tiny cartoon umbrellas to guard against another Acme anvil that voters are going to drop on their heads.
Weekdays 6 to 9 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app. Enjoying this local program? Find the complete Civic Media lineup at civicmedia.us or the Civic Media app.
For Civic Media News, I'm Shali Pittman. The Wisconsin DNR is investigating a manure spill from Bruggen Dairy Farm in Monroe County. The spill killed hundreds of fish and contaminated healthy waters frequented by fishers. For more, here's Judith Ruiz Branch.
State officials are investigating a manure spill in Monroe County that polluted at least 8 miles of waterways in southwest Wisconsin, killing hundreds of fish and contaminating Spring Valley Creek, Moore Creek, and the Kickapoo River. A massive rain event triggered the runoff from Bruggen Dairy Farm, a 600-head dairy operation near Norwalk. Ben Uvas with the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources says the farm took measures to protect the soil, but the combination of intense rain and recent manure application caused it to spill into nearby water.
Very localized and a very high intensity rainfall event hit that field, and that was what moved manure off the field down into concentrated flow channels, grass waterways, and eventually off the field into Spring Valley Creek.
The spill was reported through an anonymous tip line to the Wisconsin DNR last month. Hundreds of fish were killed, including prized trout habitats. Farmers apply manure to their fields as fertilizer, but overapplication can cause risks for drinking water and local wildlife. The dairy operation treated about 130 acres of farmland with nearly 1,200 gallons of manure per acre, which is within the DNR's acceptable standards. There have been at least 9 documented manure spills in Wisconsin this year. year. A 2022 investigation found that more than 1,500 miles of waterways and 33 lakes in Wisconsin are impaired due to manure and commercial fertilizer pollution. For Wisconsin News Connection, I'm Judith Ruiz Branch. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org. This story was produced with original reporting from Nina Elkadi for Sentient. For Civic Media News, I'm Shali Pittman.
This is your local Civic Media radio station. Want to hear even more? Anytime? Find all of it at civicmedia.us.
With your forecast, I'm Corey Hartman. Heat warnings in effect for your Saturday. We'll have highs in the mid-90s. The heat index pushes over 100 and a strong south wind. For tonight, mostly clear, a low around 79. Sunny and hot again for Sunday with a high near 96, heat index 104.
It's 79 degrees right now.
Jane Matinair and Greg Bach.
Coming up on the show, Civic Media News Director Charlie Pittman joins us to cover all the weekend news. And then we're talking ticks in hour number two with entomologist PJ Leash, the bug guy. Don't miss it.
Matinair on air, weekday mornings 9 to 11. This is Lake Air 1260 AM WLAK.
You're listening to pre-recorded content.
Welcome to Amicus, a law review with Jim Santel. Civic Media's weekly review and discussion of some of the most significant news stories in the areas of law, government, courts, and the aspiration for justice. And now, here's your host, Jim Santel.
This is Amicus Law Review. My name is Jim Santel. We are spending all of our time, virtually all of our time, on this weekend broadcast talking about some of the major Supreme Court cases issued this past week, including this landmark decision, a case called Scrimeti, takes its name from the Attorney General of the state of Tennessee, in which Chief Justice John Roberts, writing for six members of the Supreme Court, himself and five others, decides that the state ban coming out of Tennessee that prohibits medical treatments for transgendered youth can, in fact, stand, as can presumably the laws in more than 20 other states in the United States of America, noting in great detail that a lot of the scientific evidence that he has rallied, specifically a report from overseas, suggests that the safety, efficacy, and propriety of medical treatments in this area is evolving. And for that reason, because in his words, it is uncertain and unclear, it is best to leave these decisions to the legislatures, not matters for the courts to decide. And so he concludes his many-page, 24-page opinion, authored on behalf of virtually all of the members deciding against the challengers in this case, concludes that opinion by saying this. We recite, he says, those overseas reports and others, not for guidance that they may provide on the ultimate question of United States law. In other words, we're not going to decide the ultimate issue of who is actually right or wrong about the medical history and even arguably the legal implications of that. But rather, he says, to demonstrate the open questions regarding basic factual issues before medical authorities and other regulatory bodies. He says, such uncertainty affords little basis for judicial responses in absolute terms, and the calculus of effects, the manner in which a particular law reverberates in a society, is a legislative and not a judicial responsibility. He finishes up his opinion this way. He says, this case carries with it the weight of fierce scientific policy debates once again about the safety and efficacy and propriety of medical treatments in an evolving field. The voices in these debates, he writes, raise sincere concerns. The implications for all are profound. The Equal Protection Clause, again, the basis upon which this challenge is made, does not resolve those disagreements, nor does it afford us, he says, license to decide them as we see best. Our role is not to judge the wisdom, fairness, or logic of the law before us, but only to ensure that it does not violate the equal protection guarantee of the 14th Amendment. He concludes this way, having concluded it does not, we leave questions regarding its policy to the people, again, their elected representatives, and the democratic process. And so orders on behalf of a majority of the Supreme Court, many of whom, again, have written concurrences, joining in much of what he has written, also adding on their own perspectives, finding in the end that the Tennessee law can indeed stand. Can stand not only for Tennessee, but presumably for those well over 20 other states in our nation that have enacted similar kinds of legislation. Now, we know well that in addition to the majority opinion, there is also a scathing dissent. And it is written principally by Justice Sonia Sotomayor. We also have an addendum to that, if you will, by Elena Kagan. She, of course, writes this dissent criticizing her conservative colleagues to uphold that state ban. She is obviously of the different view on medical treatments for transgendered youth. She says that the justices on the other side have retreated from what she calls meaningful judicial review exactly when it matters most. She adds that the court abandons transgender children and their families to political whims. Significantly, and this happens from time to time, when a Supreme Court justice, typically in dissent, sometimes in the majority, feels very strongly about their position, they will read their dissent, they'll read their concurrence from the bench during the opinion announcement, and that happened this past Wednesday when Sonia Sotomayor took the bench, a fairly rare but not unknown step, but a situation typically reserved to emphasize a justice's, that jurist's, extraordinary displeasure with the decision. And so she read her opinion out loud. She took great issue with Justice John Roberts' view that questions about these medical treatments should be resolved only by the legislature. And she writes in her own 31-page dissent that judicial scrutiny has, in this case, long played an essential role in guarding against efforts by lawmakers, as she has described it, to impose upon individuals the state's views about how people of a particular sex or race should live or act. And again, citing cases from the past, we saw that the Chief Justice cited the Loving case having to do with opposite race marriage. She also cites another case. It's called United States versus Virginia, a 1996 case in which the court struck down the Virginia Military Institute's male-only admissions policy, along with Loving versus Virginia, which is the 1967 case that once again declared state laws prohibiting that interracial marriage unconstitutional. About all of those discriminatory policies and laws, Justice Sonia Sotomayor writes, she says those laws, too, posed politically fraught and contested questions about things like race and sex and biology. In the interracial marriage case, again, that both she and the Chief Justice cite, she wrote, as an example, Virginia has argued that if the court intervened in the matter, it would find itself in a bog of conflicting scientific opinion about the effects of interracial marriage and the desirability of preventing such alliances from the physical, biological, genetic, anthropological, cultural, psychological, and sociological point of view. This dissent was fully joined again by Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson, in part by Elena Kagan. And although justices often conclude their dissents by writing respectfully, in the essay explaining her dissent, she wrote, in sadness, I dissent. Again, she is hearkening back to those other civil rights cases in which there has been concern at the time of the decision about the kinds of things that might be out there, not only in literature, but also about the effects in society of various physical, biological, anthropological issues, and says we've got that here as well. It doesn't mean, she says, that the Supreme Court should be reluctant to find that there is indeed an equal protection argument here and a compelling one. She writes this in particular. Tennessee's ban applies no matter what the minor's parents and doctors think, with no regard for the severity of the minor's mental health conditions or the extent to which treatment is medically necessary for an individual child. The stories of the plaintiffs in this case reflect the states of that harsh reality. And she describes in great detail some of the individuals who are affected by this particular legislation. She describes him as Ryan Rowe, who's now 16, LW, just by the initials there, and also others in this line of individuals whose stories made a part of the petitions to the court. All of that presented in her very extensive and fairly scathing dissent. She goes on to say this: what does this mean in practice? She says simply that sex determines access to covered medication. And she says physicians in Tennessee can prescribe hormones and puberty blockers to help a male child, but not a female child, look more like a boy. And to help a female child, but not a male child, look more like a girl. She goes on to write, put in the statute's own terms, doctors can facilitate consistency between an adolescent's physical appearance and the, quote, normal development of her sex identified at birth. But they may not use the same medications to facilitate inconsistency with sex. All of this, Sonia Sotomayor writes, the state openly admits in service of encouraging minors to appreciate their sex. And once again, like the Chief Justice, she's invoking the legislative history that justified this in the beginning. Interestingly, she spends a lot of time talking about the case that we have also discussed here on this broadcast and others of civic media. That's the case of Bostock versus Clayton County way back in 2020, about 5 years ago. You may recall that that is the Title VII case in which the Supreme Court, written by Justice Neil Gorsuch in the majority, found that indeed the protections against employment discrimination applied indeed to everybody in the LGBTQIA community. And she describes the ways in which the Bostock principles also apply here. She says, by depriving adolescents of hormones and puberty blockers only when such treatment is inconsistent with a minor's sex, the law necessarily deprives minors identified as male at birth of the same treatment it tolerates for an adolescent identified as female at birth, and vice versa. And that is her argument, that the Equal Protection Clause under the 14th Amendment has indeed been violated. She goes on to take on the majority. She says the problem with the majority's argument is that the very medical purpose the law prohibits is defined by reference to the patient's sex. Key to whether a minor may receive puberty blockers or hormones is whether the treatment facilitates the medical purpose of helping the minor live or appear inconsistent with the minor's sex. That, she says, that, she writes, is why changing a patient's sex yields different outcomes under the law. Again, take the adolescent distressed by newly developing facial hair. Was the patient identified female at birth? The law authorizes the prescription of medication. Male at birth? The law prohibits it. And for truly sex-neutral law, she says, it is impossible to imagine a single scenario where changing a patient's sex yields a different result. To borrow, she writes, from the majority's catalog of apparently benign medical use distinctions, imagine Tennessee allowed consumption of DayQuil to ease coughs, but not minor aches and pains. The regulated medical purpose, treatment of coughs and aches and pains, she writes, are unregulated and unrelated to sex. So a patient's sex will never determine whether she can consume DayQuil. All that matters is whether the patient has a cough. So too for other instances, which she also defines in her extensive dissent in this case. In the end, she writes this: transgender people have long been subject to discrimination in healthcare, employment, and housing, and to rampant harassment and physical violence. She goes on to write this: individuals whose gender identity diverges from their sex identified at birth, whether labeled as transgender at the time or not, moreover, have been subject to a lengthy history of discrimination in the form of cross-dressing bans, police brutality, and anti-sodomy laws. She goes on to say that beginning in 1840, 3, cities ranging from major metropolitan centers like Chicago and Los Angeles to small cities and towns, including Cheyenne, Wyoming, and those in South Dakota, enacted ordinances that most commonly criminalized any person appearing upon any public street or other public place in a dress not belonging to his or her sex. In any event, those searching for more evidence of this discrimination against transgender individuals need look no further than the present. When we come back, we're going to conclude our discussion of Sonia Sotomayor's dissent and then move on to some other cases also decided this past week by the United States Supreme Court. Stay with us for that discussion.
You're listening to Lake Air, WLAK, Amory's home for Nightlight with Pete Schwabba.
At Straight Talk, we are all about no-brainers. Calling grandma for her recipe, no-brainer. Streaming one more episode at 2 a.m., big no-brainer. Getting real unlimited data where you buy bananas, the ultimate no-brainer. Switch now and get a free Samsung Galaxy A16 5G or Moto G Power 5G 2025 with select plans. Straight Talk, real unlimited data. Available at Walmart and straighttalk.com. Offer valid through 7/2025. Taxes and fees apply. Requires in-store activation of single line gold unlimited plan or higher. For network management practices, visit straighttalk.com/terms. Copyright 2025 Verizon.
Here's another community reminder from 107.5 WLAK. Ruby's Pantry distributes the second Saturday of each month. And you can check out the schedule at rubyspantry.org. That's rubyspantry.org. Ruby's Pantry, the second Saturday of each month from 7:30 to 9 a.m. And they do that at SMC Limited on Griffin Street in Avery. Another community reminder for you from 107.5 WLAK.
This fall, build your perfect Wisconsin football game day with a mini pack. Pick any three games, including Big Ten matchups like Washington, Iowa, and Ohio State, and save while cheering on the Badgers. Big matchups, big moments, and it's all on your schedule. Football mini packs are available now. Create your custom game day experience today at uwbadgers.com or call 1-800-GO-BADGERS. First touchdown to the fifth quarter, there's always something to enjoy. Football game day starts here. We'll see you at Camp Randall.
Skilled trade workers are the backbone of every community and also the Army National Guard. Soldiers trained to keep the power flowing, engines running, and in every other trade needed to accomplish the mission. These soldiers are on the fast track to learning skills that can set them up for success at home with companies looking to hire the best. Their resumes are being built through their paid training and part-time service. Find out how you too can learn a trade profession by visiting NationalGuard.com. Sponsored by the Wisconsin Army National Guard. Aired by the Wisconsin Broadcasters Association and this station.
I was stuck in a state of panic and endless rituals, so I made the call.
Mental health care works when you make the call. Visit mentalhealthcareworks.org. A message from the American Psychiatric Association Foundation.
As Wisconsin is hitting the road on your Harley, this is the Civic Media Radio Network.
You're listening to pre-recorded content.
My name is Jim Santel, and this is Amicus, a law review on the broadcast stations of Civic Media. We are appropriately spending virtually all of our broadcast this weekend talking about the United States Supreme Court and this landmark case. It's called Scrimeti. It's spelled S-K-R-M-E-T-T-I, named after the Attorney General for the state of Tennessee. Lots of vigorous dispute between the dissenters, Sonia Sotomayor and Elena Kagan, Ketanji Brown Jackson, and majority led by the Chief Justice, who writes an opinion that once again finds that the Tennessee law and laws in other states that prohibit the application, the use, the invocation of various medications and health treatments for transgender youth, the prohibitions can in fact stand because those are matters relegated to and that remain in the purview of the legislature. Needless to say, Sonia Sotomayor strongly disagrees with that, identifies many arguments in the opposite direction. And a part of the debate, a part of the contest between the Chief Justice and Sonia Sotomayor is, again, about the level of review. It is significant to note that at the core of the majority's opinion is this notion that this transgender health ban should be subject not to a higher level of scrutiny, but rather a rational basis review. That is, whether or not the law rationally advances some identified purpose of the legislature of the state in promoting the safety, the health, the welfare of the community that it serves. Sonia Sotomayor encourages a higher review because of the nature of the rights and interests that are at stake here. And she specifically takes on the Chief Justice, who does not adopt this higher level of review, by saying this. She says the majority's choice to avoid applying intermediate scrutiny is all the more puzzling because this court doesn't even have to resolve these questions or wade into what it dubs, again quoting, the fierce scientific and policy debates about the safety, efficacy, and propriety of medical treatments in an evolving fear. That indeed will be the language, the terminology that will animate the discussion about this opinion going forward. She goes on to say that the lower court, the Sixth Circuit, from which this case came, that is the appellate division, the appellate court coming out of the district court in Tennessee, the Sixth Circuit never even asked whether the challenged sex classification in the law serves some important governmental objectives or is substantially related to the achievement of those objectives. She says even the rational-based analysis is not met here. She says all the United States requested of this court was confirmation that intermediate scrutiny applied. On remand, the courts, she says, could have taken account of the recent developments that, according to the majority, underscore the need for legislative flexibility in this area, goes on to write, as she does in the last lines of her dissent, including a recent report from England's National Health Service on the use of puberty blockers and hormones to treat transgender minors. Yet, she says, the majority inexplicably refuses to take even the modest step of requiring Tennessee to show its work before the lower courts. Finally, she says this. This case presents an easy question whether the law's ban on certain medications applicable only if used in a manner inconsistent with sex contains a sex classification. She goes on to write, because sex determines access to the covered medications, it clearly does. Yet the majority refuses to call a spade a spade. Instead, Sonia Sotomayor writes, it obfuscates a sex classification that is plain on the face of this statute, all to avoid the mere possibility that a different court could strike down the law or categorically healthcare bans like it. The court's willingness, she writes, to do so here does irrevocable damage to the Equal Protection Clause and invites legislatures to engage in discrimination by hiding blatant sex classifications in plain sight. It also authorizes, without second thought, untold harm to transgender children and the parents and families who love them. That's Sonia Sotomayor writing, obviously, in strong opposition to what the majority has done this past week in connection with the Equal Protection Clause and specifically with the transgender rights issue before the court this term. Significantly, of course, this is not the end of this discussion. Plainly, in the wake of this opinion of just this past week, we're going to see an awful lot of other courts addressing applications of this. One of the issues is whether or not the Supreme Court has now identified, carved out, if you will, a special group of people for whom there is or may not be protections under the Equal Protection Clause. How does that play out? And indeed, that is some of what animates Justice Sotomayor's concern about the future. Others, of course, have come down in the opposite direction. The Attorney General of the United States of America said on social media this past week that she would, in fact, encourage other states to follow Tennessee's lead and enact similar legislation to protect our kids. And it goes on to say, of course, that this is the kind of thing that the Attorney General, the Department of Justice, would advocate for. Of course, completely contrary to what the Attorney General and the Biden administration and the Justice Department generally had asked the Supreme Court to do at the time that this case was initially before the Supreme Court. Lots more to discuss here. Many more issues in connection not only with transgender rights, but the Equal Protection Clause. Many, many other pieces of litigation going to flow from this opinion of justice past week. And of course, as always, we will take not only a look at those, report on those to you, and do analysis of exactly what it is that the lawyers say and ultimately what the courts say about the rule of law in America. Scrimeti, a major decision issued by the Supreme Court just this past week. This past week, Wednesday, the Supreme Court issued decisions in four other cases as well. And those cases involve other issues also important to the future and the life and the livelihood of our nation. When Amicus Law Review continues, we'll talk about those briefly and then talk about future cases on the docket.
Lake Air, 1260 AM WLAK.
ABC News, I'm Brian Clark. Severe weather overnight's been blamed for three deaths in North Dakota, but tens of millions of people will be dealing with dangerous heat over the next several days. Meteorologist Greg Dutcher from WLS in Chicago says,
where does the heat spread for today? It's across the entire Midwest. It's out to the eastern fringe of the Rocky Mountains and then all the way out to the eastern U.S. too, with Chicago hitting possibly 105 degrees when you factor in the heat index today.
President Trump plans to meet with his National Security Council as he weighs U.S. involvement in the Iran-Israel war. Israel overnight said it intercepted 40 Iranian drones. Iran says more than 400 people have been killed since the fighting began. Vice President J.D. Vance thanked Marines and military personnel working on immigration raids in Southern California. Los Angeles Mayor Karen Bass said he was justifying a stunt. And eight people were killed in a ballooning accident in southern Brazil. This is ABC News.
Local radio for you and your community. It's Civic Media's mission with stations across Wisconsin. Find your favorites at civicmedia.us.
Baseball in the Twin Cities. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with sports. Game two of the Brewers series this weekend against the Twins going on today. Last night, the Brewers' win was one for the record books. Milwaukee winning by a final score of 17-6 over Minnesota. 23-year-old Jacob Mizorowski, they call him the Miz, in only his second start in the major leagues, pitched a perfect game, a no-hitter, until the seventh inning when the first hit of the game from the Twins was a two-run homer. Mizorowski asked, did it feel like a special night?
Yeah, I mean, it was awesome. I mean, coming out and hearing the crowd cheering like that on a road series, it's exciting. It's awesome.
Did you feel any different emotionally or just how you were able to manage the day and your stuff once you were out there?
I think honestly I felt calmer and ready to go compared to the first one. You know, nerves were going pretty heavy on the first one, so it's good to finally feel the feet under you.
Again, the final from last night, 17-6 in favor of the Brewers. With sports, I'm Mike Clemens.
Your news, conversations, and a whole lot of fun. It's all on your local Civic Media radio station or the Civic Media app.
With your forecast, I'm Corey Hartman. Heat warnings in effect for your Saturday. We'll have highs in the mid-90s. The heat index pushes over 100 and a strong south wind. For tonight, mostly clear, a low around 79. Sunny and hot again for Sunday with a high near 96. Heat index 104.
It's 81 at our studios right now.
The Maggie Dawn Show.
Mark Sommerhauser, the communications director for the Wisconsin Policy Forum, analyzing the impacts of the big brutal bill.
That number that you mentioned of nearly $15,000 per person, literally about a quarter of the state's economy.
Basically a quarter of the state's economy coming from the federal government. I'm not hearing from Republicans in the state in their biennial budget planning any sort of contingency plan for major disruption in federal funding coming into the state.
The award-winning Maggie Dawn Show at its new time, weekdays 4 till 6 p.m.
For 75 years, the Muscular Dystrophy Association's voices have thundered through the halls of Congress.
For 75 years, we've willed the impossible into existence.
For 75 years, the MDA community has pushed the science,
shifted the narrative,
and established the field of neuromuscular medicine.
And until that day when this is all a thing of the past,
you couldn't stop us if you tried.
Join us and celebrate 75 years of breakthroughs at mda75.org.
The Todd Allbaugh Show.
The Joint Finance Committee was leaked that they intend to cut $87 million from the UW system budget. And so we put this out on our socials last night, and today the Joint Finance Committee decided to pull that from the agenda. Because apparently, from what I'm told, Republican legislators got a lot of calls. When the truth is disseminated and people react, results can happen.
The Todd Allbaugh Show, weekdays 2 to 4 on your local Civic Media radio station, and on the app.
Missed your favorite show live on air? It's easy to find what you enjoy wherever you listen to podcasts, including Spotify, Apple, and Google Podcasts. And we're always streaming on TuneIn and the Civic Media app.
We are the National Park Foundation, and together with you, we're creating a future where every person, every generation, gets their chance at an unforgettable moment. Learn more at nationalparks.org/foundation.
Pete Schwabba.
On the next Nightlight, I'm live from Madison, where I welcome the Green Bay Automobile Gallery's Daryl Burnett. And we rank our all-time favorite summer blockbuster movies. Let's light it up.
Nightlight with Pete Schwabba. Weeknights from 6 till 8.
You're listening to pre-recorded content.
This is Amicus Law Review. My name is Jim Santel, your host for the remaining segments of this weekend broadcast, all about the United States Supreme Court. Appropriately spending most of our time talking about this major decision in Scrimeti. Lots of discussion certain to follow in America and beyond, not only about the medical support or lack of support for this position, but also the implications for the Equal Protection Clause in the United States of America. Supreme Court issued five decisions on Wednesday of this past week. Let's talk about some of those as well. Equally important to the areas in which the cases are focused, including the environment, and indeed prisoner rights as well. Let's talk first about that particular case, probably not grabbing the headlines that we think about with respect to other major opinions issued by the Supreme Court, but a case called Pertu, P-E-R-T-T-U versus Richards, a case under something called the Prison Litigation Reform Act. It requires prisoners with complaints about prison conditions to exhaust their available grievance procedures before filing something in federal court. And again, here we have a petitioner who has done just that. The Supreme Court takes a look at the procedural aspects of this case and finds in the end that parties are entitled to a jury trial on PLRA exhaustion, that is, whether or not they have exhausted all of their lower remedies, when that issue is a mixed one, when it's intertwined with the merits of a claim that requires a jury trial under the Seventh Amendment. Lots to unpack there, lots, of course, to focus on. But basically, when you've got a mixed case question, the Supreme Court saying that indeed petitioners, in this case prisoners, can in fact and do indeed and are entitled to a jury trial when you've got a mixed question like that. The Seventh Amendment, of course, says in suits at common law, where the value in controversy shall exceed $20, the right of trial by jury shall be preserved, and no fact tried by a jury shall be otherwise reexamined in any court of the United States than according to the rules of the common law. Basically, an affirmation there in the Seventh Amendment of a jury trial right. And so it's an affirmation this past week under the PLRA of the right of prisoners pursuing their claims against their jailers and other officials to have a jury trial when it comes to mixed questions of law. In fact, they've done that in other areas, including a lot of sentencing cases as well, where there's both a legal issue to be addressed and also a factual issue to be addressed. What we have there in this case, Pertu versus Richards, is an exposition and a reaffirmation of that fundamental principle. Interestingly, in this particular case, we get a mix of justices buying into and supporting that. The Chief Justice once again writes that opinion. He delivers the opinion of the court. And here are the justices who support that. Justice Sotomayor, Kagan, Gorsuch, and Jackson join in that. The justices filing dissenting opinions are Justices Barrett and Thomas, Alito, and Kavanaugh. So you've got a very mixed court and a somewhat mixed disposition on this. Nonetheless, the majority holds, finding that indeed petitioners, like those in the Purdue case, are in fact entitled to a jury trial for mixed questions of law and fact. There are three other cases also decided by the Supreme Court, and they are equally interesting in their own ways. All of the 65 cases being decided by the Supreme Court this term, important, hugely significant for the petitioners themselves, but also for the very positions and legal postures that they articulate. Let's talk about one involving nuclear waste. Let's get back and figure out where this comes from. First, the case is called Nuclear Regulatory Commission versus Texas. And that's right, you've got a challenge between an agency of the federal government and some individual states. Where do we get this from? How does this case evolve? The Atomic Energy Act, 1954, that's the genesis for all of us. It prohibits private possession of nuclear materials, including spent nuclear fuel, without a license. Makes perfect sense. Goes on to say that the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, again, according to the Atomic Energy Act of 1954, can still license the possession of nuclear materials subject to certain statutory and procedural requirements. Here, there's an entity called Interim Storage Partners, or ISP, that applied for a license to build a facility in West Texas to store spent nuclear fuel. And during the ISP's licensing procedures in front of the NRC, what happens is that a Texas government agency also submits comments about the propriety of that, including on a draft environmental impact statement that was prepared by the commission for this proposed facility, again, positing some nuclear fuel in this special location. There are entities called Fasken Land and Minerals, that's a private West Texas business, and others that also submitted comments and also seeking to intervene in this licensing procedure about where, in fact, the nuclear waste should be deposited, the nuclear fuel should be spent, and going back fundamentally to the notion of process for doing all this, how is this to come about? The commission denied the petition to intervene by Fasken Land and Minerals, and Fasken then unsuccessfully challenged that denial to intervene before the full commission, and yes, indeed, ultimately went to the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals. What happens is this ultimately gets to the United States Supreme Court. It was argued back in March of this year. And interestingly, as the Supreme Court often does in this case, Supreme Court once again says that basically there's a standing problem. It says because Texas, the state, and others, including Fasken, were not parties to the commission's licensing proceeding, they submitted comments, but not a part of the proceeding itself. They are, according to the Supreme Court, not entitled to obtain judicial review of the commission's licensing decision. Goes on to say that under the thing called the Hobbs Act, you probably know that well, the Congress specified that only a party aggrieved by a licensing order of the commission may seek judicial review. In this case, the Supreme Court rules, Texas and Fasken argue that they qualify as parties because they participated by submitting comments on the draft and by attempting to intervene. But the text of the Atomic Energy Act indicates that one must be the license applicant or successfully intervene in the order to obtain party status in the commission licensing proceeding. Based upon the straightforward application of that law, the Supreme Court says these states and these particular entities are out of luck. They cannot challenge, therefore, what the Nuclear Regulatory Commission has done in this licensing for the depositing of nuclear fuel. In this particular case, interesting once again that Justice Kavanaugh delivers the opinion of the court, and he is joined in that by Chief Justice Roberts and also by Justices Sotomayor and Kagan and Barrett and Jackson. And Justice Gorsuch files a dissenting opinion. Justice Thomas and Justice Alito join in that. Again, not strange bedfellows, but it indicates that you do have those cases where opinions of Supreme Court justices differ, as they often do, and differ beyond just so-called partisan perspectives. And here you get a true mix, at least with respect to the majority finding that indeed the particular petitioners here, the states and these individual private entities, cannot contest what the Nuclear Regulatory Commission has done. That case, once again, Nuclear Regulatory Commission versus Texas and others, decided by the Supreme Court just this past week. And then we get a couple of other cases, and they proceed pretty much in parallel. They are environmental cases, although they're actually jurisdictional cases, cases that judges and lawyers and administrators love to talk about, because they all have to do with where a particular lawsuit should be brought. In what particular jurisdiction should you go? Into the D.C. Circuit Court? That is the court where most of these cases involving big federal issues are decided. Or can you go to any one of the other 12 circuit courts around the country? Actually, 11 circuit courts. The 12th, of course, is the federal circuit, but typically not the subject, not the appropriate jurisdiction for environmental cases. We've got two cases. One of them is called Environmental Protection Agency versus Calumet Shreveport Refining. And yes, indeed, you've got it right. It has to do with small refinery exemption petitions that are presented to the federal government. And there's a second case, again, in parallel to that case, called Oklahoma versus Environmental Protection Agency. How does that case get before the Supreme Court? And how are these cases related? How do they interface with each other in connection with important issues? That is, where are these kinds of contests to be decided? In what court are they to be resolved? The Clean Air Act channels challenges to Environmental Protection Agency actions to the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia if those actions are, and here's the important language, nationally applicable. In other words, they have some impact around the country, but to a regional circuit if they are locally or regionally applicable. Makes perfect sense, right? If something is nationally applicable, then it should go to the D.C. Court of Appeals. If instead you've got something that's more of a local or regional issue, then the other circuit courts should be the ones that entertain the cases. The Clean Air Act contains an exemption for certain local, regional applicable actions based on determinations of nationwide scope or effect, which can also be brought in the D.C. Circuit. Lots of administrative language here. Once again, it's a lot. The EPA, in this particular case involving Oklahoma and the EPA, aggregated its disapprovals into one omnibus Federal Register rule. And it described EPA's four-step framework for evaluating some submissions made to it under the Clean Air Act. The EPA asserted then in the rule that its disapprovals would be reviewed only in the D.C. Circuit Court as either nationally applicable actions or alternatively as local or regionally applicable actions falling within the nationwide scope or effect exemption in the law. It is very complicated. It's a lot of language and it is a lot of lawyerly manipulation, but it is important because these cases determine where indeed these litigation challenges will be decided. States and industry petitioners challenge the EPA's actions, their disapprovals in regional courts. Of the five circuits resolving the EPA's motions to dismiss or transfer, four found that regional circuit courts' reviews were proper. Only the 10th Circuit said otherwise. And so all this comes to the United States Supreme Court. And in the end, in this case, again, the Oklahoma case, what does the Supreme Court do? The Supreme Court says that EPA's disapproval of the Oklahoma and Utah requests are locally or regionally applicable actions reviewable in a regional circuit. Basically saying that indeed that is the way that these cases, that is where these cases can indeed be resolved. The case, once again, Oklahoma versus Environmental Protection Agency, significant as it is in other cases about who decides these cases, how they go in the Supreme Court, and who authors the opinions. When we come back, I'll tell you about that, and then we'll talk about yet another case also in the environmental area as Amicus, a law review, continues.
Join the family. Civic Media has a number of great jobs across the state open now at civicmedia.us/careers.
You're listening to the American Democracy Minute, keeping your government by and for the people. Voting Rights Lab reports there were 59 state bills introduced on proof of citizenship for voter registration this year, and 160 bills concerning voter ID. A handful have made it near the finish line, but not all have passed. Since President Donald Trump's baseless accusations of mail-in voting fraud in 2020 and his unfounded claims of widespread non-citizen voting in the 2024 election, Republican-dominated legislatures have raced to pass stricter voter ID and proof of citizenship laws, despite no widespread abuse of either. In New Hampshire, versions of SB 218 were advanced, requiring submission of ID and proof of citizenship for absentee registration, and are now in a committee of conference. In Texas, a high-priority documentary proof of citizenship bill died without action at the end of the session. In Texas alone, there were 15 bills introduced to provide documentary proof of citizenship and 10 tightening voter ID laws. Nevada Governor Joe Lombardo surprisingly vetoed a bipartisan voter ID bill attempting to codify a widely supported ballot initiative. Democrats negotiated expanded ballot drop boxes in exchange for supporting voter ID. His veto statement said the bill did not address implementing voter ID for mail-in ballots. Wyoming and Indiana passed proof of citizenship earlier this year. We have more at AmericanDemocracyMinute.org. I'm Brian Beal.
A game without a crowd is just a scrimmage. A performance without an audience is just a rehearsal. Without your presence, high school sports and the performing arts aren't possible. Ensure that these essential extracurricular activities continue to enrich the lives of students in Wisconsin. Purchase a ticket to your local high school's game or performance.
This message presented by the WIAA and the Wisconsin Athletic Directors Association.
Matt and Air on Air.
From articles that I have seen, if you are a bagel purist, you should not toast your bagel. I think nothing's better than a toasted bagel and a schmear.
Folks, do we have a moment of honesty? Do you really like bagels, or do you like the schmear that is transported by them? Get rid of the stigma. If I walk into this room eating cream cheese out of a tub with a spoon.
Why is that wrong?
Matt and Air on Air. Weekday mornings 9 to 11 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app. Mornings with Pat Kreitlow.
Dr. Kristen Lyerly joins us now.
3 in 4 people have no idea that the hospital I work at in northern Minnesota will likely close if this big, beautiful bill passes, as will the hospital in Manitowoc, Wisconsin. So it is incumbent upon us to have these conversations with each other, not in a hostile way, but in a genuine way about our values and the things that we deeply care about.
Mornings with Pat Kreitlow. Weekdays 6 to 9 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app. As Wisconsin has summer weekends being spent on the lake, this is the Civic Media Radio Network.
You're listening to pre-recorded content.
This is Amicus Law Review talking all about the United States Supreme Court and its 5 decisions issued just on Wednesday of this past week. All of them important, a couple of them not falling necessarily at the top of our news headlines, but important in the areas of the environment because they focus on where these cases can indeed be brought. In this Oklahoma case versus the EPA, Here is a case where Justice Clarence Thomas delivers the opinion of the court finding that indeed the EPA's disapprovals of the requests by Oklahoma and Utah are in fact locally or regionally applicable and therefore reviewable in a regional circuit as opposed to the District of Columbia. In particular, in that case, Justice Thomas is joined by Justices Sotomayor and Kagan, Kavanaugh and Barrett and Jackson. Justice Gorsuch filed an opinion concurring in the judgment, and Justice Roberts joined in that. Justice Alito took no part in the consideration or decision of the case. That matter ultimately premised, again, the underlying facts, which for purposes of the decision by the Supreme Court are still important, but the question really is what is the court that's going to decide this? Has to do with each state in this particular case, including Oklahoma, submitting an implementation plan detailing how it would comply with a good neighbor provision under the Clean Air Act, which requires the states to provide adequate provisions prohibiting in-state emissions that would interfere with other states' compliance under the Clean Air Act. That will now be adjudicated, those kinds of issues, in a regional court. Does not have to be in the District of Columbia. In a related case, this other case, Environmental Protection Agency versus Calumet Shreveport Refining, we've got some other underlying facts, and it has to do with the Clean Air Act's renewable fuel program. Most domestic refineries have to blend specified amounts of ethanol and other renewable fuels into transportation fuels that they produce. The Act provides a phased exemption scheme for small refineries, that is, those who are processing no more than about 75,000 barrels of crude oil daily, allowing them to petition the EPA for exemptions based upon the disproportionate economic impact of all of this. So it has to do with small refinery exemptions and an EPA decision that's being challenged plainly by some of those small refineries. Here, once again, the question is whether under the Clean Air Act, these cases are nationally applicable, the issues raised there, and can only be challenged in the D.C. Circuit, or whether they're local and regionally applicable actions that can belong in regional circuits. And once again, the Supreme Court says this: EPA's denial of the small refineries' exemption petitions are locally or regionally applicable actions that fall within the nationwide scope or affect exceptions requiring venue in the D.C. Circuit. Again, lots of administrative language to unpack there. What it basically means that in this particular case, again, invoking the same kind of language as we saw in the Oklahoma case, here, because of the specific facts and the particular applications of the small refinery and the exemptions that they sought, there is an exception, again, based upon a nationwide scope or effect requiring venue in the D.C. Circuit. So two different results applying the law in two different cases, both of them under the Clean Air Act, different underlying facts, different underlying predicates. And here, once again, you have Thomas, Justice Thomas, delivering the opinion of the court, joined in by Justice Alito, by Justice Sotomayor, by Justice Kagan, Justice Kavanaugh, Barrett, and Jackson. Gorsuch filed a dissenting opinion, and Chief Justice Roberts, in this case, joined in that dissenting opinion. So a lot of mix of justices coming down on different sides of these, yes, decisional cases involving where litigation can proceed. Critically important for not only the environmental cases brought under the Clean Air Act, but also for the administrative actions that are a part of these decisions. All of those things, all of those five cases, including Scrimeti, decided by the Supreme Court just this past Wednesday, and obviously more of that to come in future broadcasts of Amicus Law Review. We have traditionally, at this time of year, also talked about the decisions that the Supreme Court makes, even as it's deciding these major cases, big, small, in between, even as it's resolving these cases, it's also building its docket for the next term of the Supreme Court, which again begins in early October of this year of 2024, goes into 2025. Just this past week, the Supreme Court added two new cases for its next term. Let me tell you a little bit about those. In First Choice Women's Resource Centers versus Platkin, the court agrees to decide whether a group of crisis pregnancy centers that were faith-based nonprofits that hold themselves out as healthcare clinics and frequently provide some material support to pregnant women but try to persuade them not to have an abortion, whether they can go forward to federal court to challenge the constitutionality of a subpoena from a state attorney general, or whether they must instead pursue those claims in state court. So you've got the underlying abortion issue, reproductive rights issue, but really, once again, a procedural issue about whether or not a subpoena and compliance with it issued by a state attorney general, where should that be adjudicated? Where should we argue about that? And the question comes again before the Supreme Court, not to address the reproductive rights issue specifically, although that will plainly loom large, but rather focusing upon the notion that a state or perhaps a federal court will be the one deciding that. Then there's a second case called Chevron USA versus Plaquemines Parish, Louisiana. Supreme Court agreeing to hear a long-running lawsuit brought by Louisiana and its parishes attempting to hold certain oil companies liable for the production of crude oil in the state during World War II. A very interesting case. History. All of that coming up as a part of the next Supreme Court docket. We will be talking about more of the Supreme Court decisions in future editions of Amicus Law Review. Join us in the future weekends for our discussions of all of that and more. Have a good weekend, everybody.
You're listening to Lake Air 1260 AM WLAK Amory and 107.5 FM W298DK Amory, and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
ABC News, I'm Brian Clark. As Israel and Iran enter their second week of fighting, Israel says it intercepted 40 drones overnight. Iran says at least 400 people in the country have been killed in Israeli strikes. Where does the U.S. stand? ABC's Rachel Scott has more.
As President Trump decides whether the U.S. will take direct action on Iran, the president clearly showing he does not agree with his Director of National Intelligence, Tulsi Gabbard, who said in recent weeks the intelligence community has no evidence Iran is building a nuclear weapon at this point.
She's wrong.
A source familiar saying in the room, Gabbard argued that Tehran is not close to building a bomb, reaffirming her Capitol Hill testimony just months ago.
Tens of millions of Americans set to be affected by severe heat. There are extreme heat warnings for Chicago, St. Louis, and Milwaukee today. Eight people were killed when a hot air balloon with 21 on board caught fire in southern Brazil. This is ABC News. Lawmakers in